Blog Talk Radio.
Warning, this MP3 download is illegal. Go to www.gatemp3.com and
SpiritofAmericaParty.com and the Spirit of America Party, a radio show. Did you know that you could get Rosetta Stone right now with free 2-day shipping for $299? And if you were the United States government, you could probably get it for $99 if you ordered 30 million Rosetta Stones for English, American English. We don't want the Latinos speaking with a British accent. Isn't that something? Imagine that. Inside of 5 weeks, everybody could be speaking English instead of press one for English. It should be press one for Rosetta Stone. Okay, here we are. We're coming up on Christmas, or as I call it, Christmas, because it drives the atheist nuts. And our subject tonight is gun control, the historical record. In 1929, the Soviet Union established gun control. From 1929 to 1953, about 20 million dissidents, unable to defend themselves, were rounded up and exterminated. In 1911, Turkey established gun control. From 1915 to 1917, 1.5 million Armenians, unable to defend themselves, were rounded up and exterminated. And I saw a sad one here today. Somebody had blogged the name of a guy who had survived the Armenian extermination as a little boy. And you know how he survived? They rounded up all the boys and they put them in a building to exterminate them. And his grandmother put a dress on him and he didn't have a beard yet. And that's what saved him. How's that? Germany established gun control in 1938 when they took over. And from 1939 to 1945, 6 short years, a total of 13 million Europeans, mostly Jewish and others, who were unable to defend themselves, were rounded up and exterminated. China established gun control in 1935. From 1948 to 1952, 20 million political dissidents, unable to defend themselves, were rounded up and exterminated. Remember the Warsaw Ghetto, if they only had a gun? Guatemala established gun control in 1964. From 1964 to 1981, 100,000 Mayan Indians, unable to defend themselves, were rounded up and exterminated. Uganda established gun control in 1970. From 1971 to 1979, 300,000 Christians, unable to defend themselves, were rounded up and exterminated. Cambodia established gun control in 1956. From 1975 to 1977, 1 million educated people, unable to defend themselves, were rounded up and exterminated. In 1990s, Rwanda established gun control. In a span of 100 days in April 1994, under Clinton watch, 800,000 people who were unable to defend themselves were massacred to death, mostly by machetes. How many dead, hacked-up bodies do you think were found holding a loaded gun? Zero. Defenseless people rounded up and exterminated in the 20th century because of gun control, 56 million. How's that grab you? You want to hear one? You want to hear one that's a little bit of a heartbreaker? This is, you know, you don't know how many liberties you have lost already. Everybody thinks we're all, they tell us we're the land of the free. A woman that I know and love died. She was born in Manhattan, New York. Now, what I'm reading you is the obituary that the newspaper gave the family for free. The youngest of 7 children, she married my grandfather, my father-in-law, I'm sorry, in 1938. And resided in the Washington Heights section of Manhattan, until moving to Staten Island in 1980. She was the mother of two children. One is my wife, and the other is my brother-in-law, who died at a very early age. In addition to her daughter, she is survived by her son-in-law, that's me, her four grandchildren, three girls and a boy, her grandson-in-law, and great-grandchildren, three more to add to the team, and one was born after she died. She was an avid swimmer, a gifted cook and homemaker. Now, her daughter wrote up this obituary. She enjoyed her part-time work and co-workers at Morgan Guarantee and Trust. She enjoyed getting together with friends at local senior citizens clubs, taking trips with her family, which included many nieces and nephews, and visiting with her grandchildren. She was tenderly cared for by friends, family, and all of the very special staff at the Carmel Richmond Nursing Facility. She was welcomed into heaven on Palm Sunday. The newspaper struck the last line, said we couldn't use it. How's that? Freedom of speech? How much you got left? And when I came to Staten Island, that newspaper was a conservative newspaper. Now it's a communist rag. And the newspaper boy starves because we don't get a delivery. It is really sad, the things that happen to America along the way down. So let's see what else we got here. We got a little, you want a tune? I'll give you a tune. It is sad, isn't it, when you can't mention anything about heaven? Yeah, what are we doing? Are we in the hands of a devil or an angel?
Devil or angel, I can't make up my mind. Which one you are, I'd like to wake up and find. Devil or angel, dear, whichever you are. Like an angel, your smile is divine, but you keep me guessing, will you ever be mine? Devil or angel, please say you'll be mine. Love me or leave me, I made up my mind. Devil or angel,
watching the demonstrations for a $15 minimum wage. And there's a sadness that goes along with that. And one sadness is $8 an hour is not enough. But the other sadness is that people are in play and are being used by unscrupulous people. And it also breeds communism and union control. You know, there's no difference between a union and a mob sometimes, especially if the mob runs the union. And they cut themselves in for a piece of the action, just like the government does to your salary, the meager one you're making. But I don't like it when I hear people talking about taking from the rich, and like the rich are exploiting people. So they're demonstrating against like a Burger King. And there are ringers in the crowd, or what the communists call stunt makers. And there are hired troublemakers in that crowd who probably don't work at all. And some poor guy that's really true to his school is out there and believing everything that they're pumping. And he's the guy that's going to get hurt the most. But anyway, the sad part about it is the government that created this incident, the communist government, and fed the fires of demonstrating for a better living wage, they have a vested interest in the deal. So if you go to $15, that means you pay more taxes and the government gets more of a cut. So the government has got skin in the financial game. But what's really sad is the guy that's going to have to pay the $15 gets no credit because the government creates the impression he was forced to do it. And the government is the hero because they forced him to do it. So what happens? The guy gets no credit. He's the one that has to pay the bill. The government gets a bigger share of tax revenue. They didn't have $1 invested, and yet they're taking a cut like a mafia. And the people that used to make, say, $10 an hour are now going to go to $15. But the people that were making $16 an hour, they're not going to get anything, or else they're going to ask for parity. So their salary may go from $16 an hour to $25 an hour. So that's how the vicious cycle begins. And the worst part about it is the owner of that business, which in many instances is stockholders who have their little 401k and their little nest egg, and they're counting on the profits of that Burger King to give them a better retirement, they now have to take less money. So it's not one big guy sitting up on top making billions and signing checks and doing nothing else like one guy called in and said today. But it's stockholders. Now you take a look at the GM situation when GM was about to collapse. The government came in and saved it. They saved it with your Social Security money. And they got rid of half of the stockholders and didn't pay them anything. And then they let the unions run the business. So now they're making money, but they're not paying back those people whose goods they coveted. And they really didn't file bankruptcy. So it's a hijacking. But you don't see it that way. And the guy who's giving the raise, and if it's a small business guy who's got a hamburger joint, the guy that's giving the raise doesn't get credit. The government gets credit. So the government ends up having more slaves than they had before, who gladly do everything the government tells them to do. And the government is buying your freedom with your tax money. Okay, so having said that, I decided, you know what? Let's give a raise to the people that deserve it the most. Not that the guy making $8 doesn't deserve more money. But whatever money that guy gets in that hamburger joint, the price of the hamburgers is going up. So you got a raise, but the price of food went up. So where are you? So if you want to give money to somebody that really deserves it, how about we start a petition to double military pay? How's that sound? You know, you double the private's pay, the corporal's pay, the sergeant's pay. we double it. So this way their wives don't have to work at three jobs while these guys, because they can't work a second job in Afghanistan. They can't work a second job in Iraq. They can't work a second job on an aircraft carrier. They can't work a second job in Djibouti. You know what I mean? So their wives have to carry the financial burden while raising kids. So let's double their pay. Why not? Who deserves it more? And not only that, all you got to do, somebody's got to start a petition and we send it to the congressman. What congressman is going to say, I'm not doubling their pay and get reelected? Huh? If there's enough patriotic people in this country, no congressman would dare oppose doubling the military pay. I was saying double it up to lieutenants. But I think once you get into the officer corps, you got to be very careful. But the enlisted man's corps, we could take care of. And then maybe we can work out something for the officers. But definitely the enlisted men got to get more money. So double their pay. It'll be less money for the communists to squander. Less money for terrorist sanctuaries like Pakistan. Instead of just thanking the troops for their service, let's really support them. Instead of phony politicians making speeches like we're the strongest nation on the face of the earth until China takes Japan, which will never happen. My favorite cliche is the one that the fools use, blood and treasure. All these politicians who never got a paper cut are talking about blood and treasure. Let's give up a little bit of the treasure to the guys who spill their blood. How about that? How about American oil for American blood? Yeah, that's how we'll pay for it. We'll drill and pay the bill. Let's not forget to double the combat zone death benefit and loss of each limb and or vital organ. Let's double down for the boots on the ground. Can we get this done before Christmas? Let us show the government we're faster than Obamacare. Merry Christmas, everybody, and happy holy days. Stand by. We're going back. We're going to go to the couch, as Dean Martin used to say. Let's go to the couch now. We'll do an Is It Any Wonder? Double the military pay. This way, at least, you'll see where your money's going.
Is it any wonder that I've fallen for you? You're the spell I'm under, and I'm helpless, it's true. Is it any wonder why my skies are so blue when I search the I feel like I do.
Watch. That's the name of this article. It's a journal. Let me see what it says. Apologize for the delay. I do three sneezes. That was a two. NPR asked Ted Kennedy why he was so wrong in 1965 about immigration. Kennedy is evasive. In 1965, during the Senate floor debate over the Immigration Act, Ted Kennedy stated, first, our cities will not be flooded with 1 million immigrants annually. Secondly, the ethnic mix of this country will not be upset. These statements have turned out to be totally false, and it should have been apparent to Kennedy that this was the case way back in the late 70s. It would have been honorable of him to have come to the Senate floor and stated something like, we goofed big time on this bill. Terribly sorry, and here's a new bill to cut back on our immigration levels, and I urge its passage. Of course, that never happened. I often wondered if Kennedy had ever been interviewed about it, and if he would have admitted he was either lying in 65, or if not, if he felt any guilt about how wrong he was. It turns out that NPR did interview him about it in 2006, just as he began to push for another immigration bill that ultimately failed. After a couple of softball historical questions, Jennifer Luden asked the following with Kennedy's reply. What's striking about the debate in 1965 is how so many people did not expect a huge increase in immigration or a change in the demographics of the nation. You told Congress that immigration levels would remain substantially the same, and that the ethnic mix of this country would not be upset. Why weren't these changes foreseen? Hang in one second. Kennedy, there were enormous changes as a result of illegal immigration. A lot of antagonism, frustration, and anger is better focused at the illegality and the illegals that came here in very significant numbers. People are certainly frustrated by the illegality and the explosion of illegals who come here that have impact in terms of the economy, depressing wages and taking jobs. But on the other hand, they have this incredible admiration and respect for their neighbor, the person at the corner store who's working 18 to 20 hours a day. They're trying to provide for their family. Is he going to get $15 an hour now, too? Yeah, I bet you the Kennedys don't pay $15 an hour. They admire those immigrants they see in church, churchgoers who are trying to bring their kids up. And so there's a very significant ambivalence in people's minds. Question. But the level of even legal immigration has increased dramatically since 1965, even though many supporters of the legislation then said it would not. Kennedy, everybody obviously wants to come because this is the land of opportunity for another couple of weeks. But we've seen a rather dramatic shift as well in terms of the birth rate here. That was really not foreseen. You're having now the leveling off of the birth rate here among a number of families. You certainly saw that in the terms of Europe and Western Europe. So there is an actual decline. I don't think we foresaw that so much at the time 40 years ago, but that is a fact, and that sends all kinds of messages. To be energized, we need new workers, younger workers, who are going to be part of the whole economy. We don't have them here in the U.S. You know what else we don't have here in the U.S.? Factories. There are greater outreach efforts being made in terms of trying to keep people in the labor market longer. We need to have the skills of all of these people. The fact is that this country, with each new wave of immigrants, has been energized and advanced, quite frankly, in terms of its economic, social, cultural, and political life. Just don't have them too close to Hyannisport. And I think that's something that will continue into the future. I don't think we ought to fear it. We ought to welcome it. Some have suggested it was a mistake to make a question. Some have suggested it was a mistake to make family reunification the main purpose of our immigration law. They say perhaps we should have a system more like Canada's, which is not going to die as quickly as the USA, which lets people in based largely on their skills. How do you respond to these criticisms? I think our tradition of the Statue of Liberty is to be willing to accept the unwashed as well as the highly skilled. There are how many unwashed you got at your house, Ted? There are a lot of people who haven't had opportunities in other places as a result of dictatorships and totalitarian regimes like we now have with Obama, and discrimination. Are we going to say we refuse to let any of those individuals come in because we got someone who has happened to have a more advantaged situation? I'm not sure that's what this country is all about. What is this country all about, Ted? Huh? What is it? Tell us. How come the Irish curse your name because you stopped them from coming here? And that was the end of the interview. At least that's all there is on the NPR website. It seems so brief, almost as if Kennedy was getting uncomfortable with the questioning and cut it short. So what is this writer saying? Given the chance to be honest, Kennedy instead gives us a typical wishy-washy politician's answer. These politicians should all be in Afghanistan tomorrow morning, taking the place of frontline troops and preaching and singing Kumbaya as they walk through the minefield. First blaming the unexpected increase on illegal immigration, which had nothing to do with the 1965 Act, which was about giving an equal chance for anybody to immigrate to America legally. And then he then tries to justify the increase by talking about a completely new subject, America's birth rate, as if the unexpected modest drop in the birth rate of the native-born could somehow justify a massive increase in immigration. The truth of the matter is that the 1965 Act had a provision for unlimited non-quota increases for family members in addition to the quota or primary part of the bill. This led to what has become known as chain immigration and the overall skyrocketing illegal numbers. This provision must have been ignored or overlooked in 1965, but Kennedy and his supporters should have known of his potential. Some people in Washington did know about it, the same interviewer also reports. In 1965, the political elite on Capitol Hill, one term per termite, everybody, you want to put an end to all of this democratism? One term per termite. You get one term of office, you get your crap, you get out, no pensions. You thank you for your service and get out there and sign up for Obamacare. In 1965, the political elite on Capitol Hill may not have predicted a mass increase in immigration, but Marion Smith, the historian for Customs and Immigration Services, showed me a small agency booklet from 1966 that certainly did. It explains how each provision in the new law would lead to a rapid increase in applications and a big jump in workload. More and more, so as word trickled out, to those newly eligible to come. I was in Kuwait in 1998. I was in the American Embassy in Kuwait to visit somebody in the Commerce Department. And as I walked in, they had a big holding room, and it was people deep. There had to be 80 to 100 people standing there. It was lunchtime. These were mostly Indians and Bangladeshis, and they were applying for a visa to the United States because in Kuwait they were making $80 a month, and they felt that their chances would be better. They had a job in Kuwait, and they felt that their chances in the USA would be better. And as soon as they seen you an American, they would ask if you could sponsor them to come to the USA. And that was one embassy. Can you see it throughout the world? I'd love to see a copy of that booklet from 1966, issued fully 2 years before the 65 Act actually went into effect in 68. It's a shame there wasn't more opposition to the bill back then, for we now know that the 1965 Immigration Act, originally supposed to be a minor addition to the 1964 Civil Rights Act, has become one of the most profound and infamous of any legislation ever to come out of Washington. The communists are great. They pull at your heartstrings. They play on your conscience. And then they destroy your mind. So they pull on your heartstrings. They'll always show. They'll never show you a baby in a chop shop in a bucket, because that's their program. But they'll show you some starving Mexican child who's here in the United States hiding from immigration. But they'll never show you the 4,700 babies they kill every day. And that's why we got a people shortage. 1,200,000 we kill every year. And guess how many immigrants come in here? Are you ready? 1,200,000. So, having said that, I'm going to try and take you back to our website, Blog Talk Radio. This is the Spirit of America Party radio show. Hang in there. Oh, man, I hate this. I hate this. I got to go back and find my website. Oh, wait a minute. I know how to do it. Internet radio. I was there. I was right there. I'm going to the studio. There we go. We're back. Find you a nice tune. You want to hear Gene Autry back in the saddle again? You want to hear the funeral march for President Lincoln? Do you know that you can go and search all day long to find Killing Lincoln on TV? But if you skip five channels at a time, you will find Lincoln the Vampire Hunter. And so I saw a kid coming out of a high school class, and I said to him, who was Abraham Lincoln? And you know what he said? He said he freed the vampires.
Tiene una pena, dicen que tiene una pena que la hace llorar. Altanera, preciosa y orgullosa, no permiten la quieran consolar. Pasa luciendo su real majestad, pasa camina los míos sin verlos jamás. La Virginia tiene pena y dolor. La Virginia no conoce el amor. Altanera, preciosa y orgullosa, no permite ni la quieran consolar. Dicen que alguien ya vino y se fue, dicen que pasa las noches llorando por él. ¡Mi mariachi! quieran consolar. Dicen que alguien ya vino y se fue. Dicen que pasan las noches llorando por él. Dicen que pasan las noches llorando por él. Dicen que pasan las noches llorando por él.
This is from the desk of Walid Shubat, former Muslim Brotherhood member, now peace activist. His question is, did Obama's uncle commit perjury at immigration hearing? This week, Barack Obama's uncle, Onyango Obama, was granted permanent resident legal status by an immigration judge in Boston. Onyango was the half-brother of Barack Obama Sr., and has been in the U.S. since 1963 illegally, since 1970. Onyango was asked by his attorney, Margaret Wong, during the hearing to identify any relatives in the USA. And he appears to have admitted a very controversial one, presumably under oath, via the Los Angeles Times. That's where the following is taken from. During the hearing, Juan asked the 69-year-old liquor store manager whether he had any relatives in America. Obama said he had a sister, two nieces, and a nephew. Asked to name the nephew, he replied, Barack Obama, he is the President of the United States. Judge Leonard, shaking in his shoes, Shapiro, ruled from the bench that Onyango Obama qualified for a provision in federal immigration that allows immigrants who have lived in the United States since before 1972 and have good moral character to apply for legal permanent residency, also known as a green card. The truth is that Onyango has two nephews in America, Barack Obama and Malik Obama. Malik is the half-brother of President Obama and has been a resident in the U.S. for decades. Malik Obama, a resident of the United States, has lived in Washington, D.C. since 1985, where he worked with various firms before becoming an independent financial consultant. In his office are framed photographs of himself with President Obama in the Oval Office and another at the president's wedding where he was best man. He lives in the United States where he takes up work contracts from time to time in Kenya. Since the question about relatives in the U.S. was posed to Onyango by his own attorney, it's reasonable to conclude that she knew how he was going to answer. Why did Onyango omit Malik in his response to the question? Are we to believe he didn't know Malik and has been a U.S. resident for 28 years? Those who seek to split hairs by responding that Malik may be in Kenya run into a bit of a problem, too. You see, earlier this year, a complaint, case 1761, was filed against Malik Obama in Egypt. The Attorney General in that country, Hisham Barakat, and the former Constitutional Court Judge, Tahani al-Jabali, have taken interest in that complaint. The man who filed it, Dr. Sadek Ebaid, reported that he was informed by his attorney that when officials at the Kenyan embassy attempted to serve Malik with papers, they couldn't because Malik was not in the country. Guess where the ambassador said Malik was? Soon after the case was filed, El Ganzori was permitted to serve Malik Obama with papers. He did so at the Kenyan embassy. Recently, after being called back to the embassy, the papers were returned to El Ganzori with a message that Malik is not in Kenya at this time and could not be served. El Ganzori was told Malik is in the U.S. I expect the next course of action to be that papers will be presented to the American embassy so that Malik can be properly served. It is worth reiterating that an attorney representing a client on an expired visa would be careful to know how her client is going to answer at his own hearing. It was Wang's duty to know if the answers given by her client were truthful. It was also her duty to know exactly how many relatives Oyango has in the USA and who they are before she asked the question. This leads to the question about why Malik's name would not be mentioned by Oyango. Could it have anything to do with the strength of the case against him? So who knows, right? Only God knows. And that's from the desk of Walid Shubat, who's a tough guy, and he's trying to do the right thing. So let's see what else we got. We did a tune. I got to find something. I don't like tunes more than 2 minutes long. Ah, here's one. This one will drive the atheist nuts.
When the twilight is gone, and no songbirds are singing, when the twilight is gone, you come into my heart, and here in my heart you will stay.
He's a professor up in Harvard. He's a friend of Obama's. He was breaking into his own house, and somebody called the cops. And he apparently didn't have a key. And the cops, because there had been robberies in the area, you know, they approached him and asked him for identification, and he got uppity, which is a bad word to use. Let's just say he got annoying. So I think the cops arrested him, and he said, "You don't know who you're dealing with." And then President Obama came out and denounced the police force. So then it turned out to be that President Obama overstepped his bounds, which he does all the time, and he called for a truce, and he brought the cop off with a beer. He says, "Come up here, and we'll give you a beer." And the cop doesn't want to lose his job, and he doesn't want any vendettas, you know, to take place 6 months later. So he went and had a beer with the guy he should have arrested again.
But this Gates is a character, and he's a racist. Racists come in all colors. But I saw him in a documentary years ago, and he was traveling the entire coastline of Africa. I forget which coast, west coast maybe, of Africa. And he was going from country to country. And as he entered each country with his cameraman, he would have, he would do the Salaam Aleikum routine. Hey, Allah, Salaam Aleikum, my brothers and my brothers and Kif El Halik, Elan Wasahelan. And, everybody went along with it because they seen cameras, they seen American, they seen money. Yeah, how you doing? He got down to a country that used to trade slaves. They had holding pens on the beaches. And what they would do is stronger tribes would go in and prey on weaker tribes and tie them up and bring them to the beach pens. And then they would auction them off to white slavers from the USA and Britain and anywhere else of France. And the first slaves that were brought to the United States were brought on a Dutch slave ship. But anyway, so he's in this town, he's in this city, and he meets with the head man, the mayor or whatever he is, and he happens to be Arab, and he has an Arabic translator, an Arabic to English translator. So Gates goes into his routine, Salaam Aleikum, my brothers, we are all brothers, aren't we? And the two Arabs start laughing. And he goes, now he's got a camera running, and he goes, what's so funny? And the Arab says, you are African, we are Arabs, brother. Yeah, and that's how that goes, all right? So, and there are countries that still practice slavery. You want to hear one? Muslim puts castrated slave for sale on Facebook. Peace be upon you. This is on Facebook. I have a male slave I bought from an African country and arranged for his visa and stay till I got him to Saudi Arabia. His description, one black skin, tall, 172 cm, weight 60 kilos. Castrated, excellent for working with a family. You can check him with a doctor or yourself if you have experience in this matter. His health is quite undamaged and he has no imperfections. He is 26 years old. His religion is Muslim and is obedient and will not disobey you except in what displeases God. Please, the matter is very serious and this is not a joke. You like that? Yeah? Are you repulsed? Yes, you have to be careful. It is really sick. It's a sick world out there. And the good people, the ones who practice the American creed of the strong must protect the weak, always including the unborn, are becoming fewer and fewer. And evil is getting darker and darker. So, we'll go now to advice to Granny. A grandmother, I think she was about 75 years old, was attacked by two guys. I think they wanted to rob her. It wasn't one of those polar bear hunts. But it happened that she had a gun. And she shot one of them and they shot her. And I think she survived. So there was another granny who didn't have a gun, and she got mugged and beaten bad. So I did a blog, and it said, Granny, get your gun. Instead of going to play Mahjong, go to the pistol range. Have the nice man pick out a pistol that fits your grip and practice. Once you have mastered the art of bullet placing, then practice some shoot-back cliches. Try, go ahead, make my lunch. Or how was that? Was it good for you? And then there is always, I only winged you. Stop your whining or I'll blow your head off. Then practice your helpless decoy routine. Don't forget to walk with a limp. If Governor Cuomo tells you that you don't need 10 bullets to kill a deer, tell him you saw deer with deer rifles. All that matters, Granny, is that you be safe. And the American creed is the strong must always protect the weak, including the unborn. Go, a Granny, go. Like that? Not bad, huh? Okay, let's see what else we got. Oh, that's a nice tone. But being that we, it's night and day is a nice tone too. You like, isn't it nice those old Cole Porter songs, and they all have words that everybody can understand. We'll do the Platters. Oh, no, I can't do the Platters. Okay. You want to do Phantom of the Opera?
like that?
Wow, how do you hit those high notes like that? Should drones be used to spot weed farms? Once the country goes 100% junkie, weed farms will spring up across the land, much of it government-owned. The price of weed will drop in Mexico as mules will no longer have as many jobs. The narco-democrats will have to turn to other substances to improve their bottom line. Made in the USA will be the ad word. Another milestone has been reached. The Obama government has taken over mob business. Now Uncle Sam is into gambling, bribery, narcotics, bunko if you count Wall Street insider trading by the House of Ill Repute and the Senate. Or is that prostitution if you count the champagne contributions? The healthcare hoax is like buying a foreclosed home in Arizona. You can only see it from the outside. Would you buy a house from Nancy Pelosi? How about a car? Hey, Nancy, this car has no steering wheel or seats. Buy it first, and then you can see what's in it. What engine? The entire drug criminal element in the USA is going to compete against the U.S. government. They will be at least 25% cheaper on the black market. Wait till you see the cigarette companies that start mass production runs. Today, only two states are in the game with 48 to go. What potential? The only guy that is going to lose business is the sign maker. This is a drug-free school zone. Now you can buy it legally from the teacher. She'll teach you how to filter it through your class condom. Smoking cigarettes is banned, but weed whacking is good for the environment. You can smell that shit blocks away, but it is harmless. The DEA no longer sprays crops with paraquat. However, in order to soup up the kick, the boys lace weed with God knows what. It is burdensome for a weed runner to carry two bales at a time. It is much easier to deliver 10,000 ecstasy pills. And don't forget, from the guy that's selling illegal drugs, you can also buy guns. Not to worry, a rehab with a 23% success rate is on your parents' health care. They're talking about kids are going to sign up for Obamacare. Do you know what a kid is today in Obamacare talk? 27 and up. Yeah, because the 26 and down are living with mommy, and they're on mommy's health care plan. Yeah, he's driving a Jeep, but he's not in the Army. Gets all his cigarette money from his mommy. You can live in the basement and never come out until you are 26 on Dad's overtime. When the door opens to the basement, be sure you're at the bottom of the steps waiting to catch the flying cheese slices. If you're spending too much of your student loan on heroin, you may be able to get a grant for $20. Even better, you can become a dealer and get a government franchise. The recovering rate from heroin is less than 1%. You may want to get product liability and malpractice insurance. And be sure to get your product FDA and DEA approved. And if you want the latest update on America's big medicine, you get my book, The Spirit of America Party. Go to the most important chapter, chapter one, entitled Drugs Suck. Be sure to stay, get my 100% stay drug-free guaranteed advice. Never do the first one. There's a company called Veteran Beer Company, and they are making, there's a new beer in town. It's brewed by vets. Americans loved Bud, then Bud sold out to the Belgians, and this ad seemed... And their ads now seem less patriotic. They took the American pride out of Budweiser. Sorry, I'm a made in USA guy. My dream is to see all American industry chugging along. I love mom and pops. It is time to reunite. A bartender, make mine American. The Veteran Beer Company was founded in 2012 on the 4th of July. By disabled combat military veterans and dedicated to producing, selling, and delivering beers of superior quality and taste and creating meaningful post-service careers for military veterans. The company strives to employ veterans in every role within the organization and the supply chain while adhering to the highest principles of military service, conducting business with integrity, courage, and loyalty. The company is committed to being a preeminent beverage manufacturing company
inspired by the highest traditions and principles of the U.S. military. Their website is www.veteranbeercompany.com. It pays to support them. And when they get real big, they'll sell out to the Belgians too. No, let's hope not. Let's hope not. Let's hope they do the right thing. Okay, so that's our show for tonight. Will I leave you with a tune, or should we just say sayonara? Let's see what we got. And we'll do a little tribute to the flag. How's that? Oh, we'll do, you know, we'll do a pub with no beer.
By the campfire at night, where the wild dingoes call. But there's nothing so lonesome, so dull or so drear, than to stand in the bar of a pub with no beer. Now the public is anxious for the quota to come. There's a faraway look on the face of the bum. The maid's gone all cranky and the coop's acting queer. Well, a terrible place is a pub with no beer. The stockman rides up with his dry, dusty throat. He breasts up to the bar, pulls a wad from his coat. Puts a smile on his face, quickly touches him a sneer. When the barman says suddenly, the pub got no beer. On the veranda for his master he waits, but the boss is inside drinking wine with his mates. He hurries for cover and he cringes in fear. There's no place for a dog round a pub with no beer. Oh, Billy the blacksmith, the first time in his life, has gone home cold sober to his darling wife. He walks in the kitchen, she says, "You'll really be dear." Then he breaks down and he tells her, "There's a